Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. In just a few moments, you're going to hear the sounds from the scenes of Thailand earlier this month. Protesters taking to the streets of Bangkok, blocking polling sites. All of this in an apparent move to disrupt the country's general election. This recent wave of demonstrations first erupted last year following the introduction of an amnesty bill that would have protected controversial ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. Opposition forces are now calling for the resignation of his sister, Ying Luck, who currently serves as prime minister. Now, the conflict has divided the country along class and geographic lines, rural north against urban residents in the south. Today on Global Journalist, we'll explore the origins of the crisis and discuss what it'll take to resolve the conflict in Thailand. Later on in the show, I'll speak with a reporter who works for the Voice of America and also with a political observer and author who's been based in Thailand for the past 30 years. But first, Tanya Doxone grew up in the northern Lapong region of Thailand. After getting her master's degree at the Missouri School of Journalism, she returned to her native country and since 2010 has reported for the Associated Press. I spoke with her yesterday about the elections, the so-called yellow shirt opposition, and the red shirts that support the ruling government.
What we're seeing is totally a different, like basically the opposite side of the protesters who came out in 2010 and calling for basically the new elections. You know, that's what they wanted. And then, of course, you know, the government that they backed already came in and they were in the office for two and a half years. And now the middle class people and then the urban middle class people are, you know, out on the streets and doing the same thing all over again. They're calling for the Pheu Thai party, which is the ruling party, to step down. And they're demanding for an unelected council to go into to be the government and spearhead the reforms, especially on anti-corruption issues in Thailand.
Give us a sense of what it is like as an AP reporter down in the trenches covering this, because, you know, on the one hand, we see some pretty remarkable things in terms of political protest. We see people armed only with whistles and plastic clappers taking over a ministry building. But on the other hand, we see 10 people have died in this violence. So it seems a little bit of a disconnect, like there's nonviolent and then there's violent protest going on.
Right. I would say that this is, this is some kind of like a nature of a protest that has been going on in Thailand, during the red shirt as well. You know, they came out, you know, protesters came out on the streets, you know, they are having fun, you know, like singing, dancing to this music. And then they're having basically right now what we're seeing in Bangkok is like, we're having like a walking street, you know, like a shopping street in major intersections in Bangkok. But at the same time, on the fringes of these gathering or all of these rally sites, you know, you're seeing threats, you're seeing grenades being thrown, you're seeing sporadic shootings. So that's something, that kind of violence is something that, you know, the, both sides do not want to see. And that's something that can be really worrisome.
People on the outside, people in the United States might look at all of this and say, wow, Thailand is just one crazy sort of developing sort of democracy. You know, it's one reporter that I saw from the BBC described it as a merry-go-round, that the political system seems to be very unpredictable. And then looming in the background is the military at any given moment, I'm guessing.
Right. What we have seen since the 2006 coup is the desire of the people, the pro-establishment people, to have the military come out again, you know, against the government that they cannot beat in the polls, basically. But this time the military has been very cautious and very wary about stepping out. You know, the current army chief, although he's very, you know, aggressive and vocal, he has made it clear that, you know, the military will not come out because they have their image has been tarnished in the last coup, and the international pressure has been mounting against them. So it seems like they will not, you know, they will not choose that path of coming out and stage another coup.
So what happens? I mean, Yingluck called for snap elections February 2nd. The opposition said that's not enough. Those have since been delayed. So what happens now?
Right now, it's a frustrating moment of you know, all the people in Thailand, you know, in every side, because during the elections on February 2nd, tens of thousands of the polling stations, you know, were not able to open for voting. Because the protesters, you know, the anti-government protesters were blocking it, or they were blocking the district offices that that were to distribute all the ballot papers. So basically, there are several constituencies in Thailand who didn't vote, like people couldn't go to vote. So right now, the Election Commission is trying to have another election, you know, in April 27th. Yeah. So right now, it seems like everyone is waiting to see whether, you know, history will repeat itself, you know, like February 2nd or not.
So on the streets, are people hopeful, or are they? And I know it depends on who. I mean, it seems like the red shirts continue to stay home for now, choosing to not engage, as it were, not seeing any strength. So is this something that is just at an impasse and ends in stalemate, or does it go somewhere? Does it get worse? Does it get better?
I mean, at this point, it seems like things are, you know, very standing very still. I mean, the red shirts, they do not want to come out because, you know, if there are clashes and if there are more deaths, that's going to cast a very bad image on the government that they're backing. And it seems like, you know, the government is trying to let the number of supporters of the anti-government people, you know, sort of, you know, decrease like on their own. I mean, right now, if you go, the number is not as large as they used to be when they started off 3 months ago, and seems like the anti-government people were really waiting for what they call a judicial coup, which basically is the constitutional court throwing you know, a ruling that may dissolve the ruling party, or, you know, kick the prime minister or the cabinet out of their posts.
Sure.
You know?
So the next election is now scheduled for late April, which is a long way away, right?
Right. I mean, the government will still have to endorse it first. I mean, the prime minister will have to say, we have to approve those dates too. But that's what the national polling body has agreed.
But until then, the opposition parliamentarians have stepped out, have they not?
Right. I mean, they, you know, right now, since the parliament dissolution, everyone, you know, there are no MPs anymore in Thailand. And
right.
Then, you know, the opposition party said that they would boycott this election. So
who's running the government right now?
Right now, Yingluck Shinawat and her cabinet ministers are still running the government, although they're the caretaker government. So there are limitations in their power. They cannot you know, introduce any policies that will be committal for the next government to come in, and you know, that's some, and that, you know, somehow deals, they claim that it deals with the rice scheme as well. You know, they say that they cannot seek loans to pay all the debt to the farmers because of the limited power of the caretaker government.
Reporters aren't asked often to look into a crystal ball, let alone to try to predict what the future might be. But I'm going to ask you to do that just the same. Short term, long term. Do you have a sense of where this might go, or is it just too tenuous at this moment?
I mean, at this moment, it's really hard to predict. You know, when it first began, everyone thought that, oh, it will be over by, you know, like 1 or 2 months because, you know, they thought that the military will somehow intervene. But then, you know, once it's been dragged to this point, it's really hard to predict because the government has made it clear that they will not repeat the same thing that the Democrat government did in 2010, which is to crack down on the protesters. So, I mean, right now, I guess, you know, you just have to wait until the protesters lose their steam and yield to some kind of options or offers that the government is going to make.
Final question. Is this a bad thing or a good thing that this is kind of how democracy plays out in your home country?
It is really frustrating from the point of view of many Thais, you know, that we are basically just like a merry-go-round. You know, you've seen the same thing happen before the coup in 2006. You know, the yellow shirts came out and asked for Thaksin to be thrown out, and Thaksin, you know, ally government came in two or three times, and then, you know, they're thrown out again. And, you know, it's like you're running in circles. So it's really frustrating for a lot of Thais.
What haven't I asked you that you think is really important for people around the world to know, either as a journalist or as a citizen?
I think the fact that you know, the ongoing crisis has not had so much impact on the country's economy. I mean, the World Bank, you know, this week they made a forecast that the GDP will still grow like 4%, although the Thai National and Social Economic and Development Board say that it might be lower than that because of you know, domestic consumption is falling. But we have not seen any significant impact on the Thai economy in general. Although tourism industry is basically, you know, hit the hardest, but that's basically in Bangkok as well. You know, I talked to a couple of, you know, hotel entrepreneurs, and the occupancy rate of one hotel next to the rally site is like 17%. So that's really low. But the rest of the country is still doing fine. People are still going to the beaches and
tourism is good, and the airport is open, and so business is open, sort of in as much as usual can be given the circumstances.
Right. Yes.
That was my interview with AP reporter Tanya Doxone, recorded yesterday in our studios. Now, before we begin, or rather continue our discussions, I want to remind everyone you can view or listen to this program anytime by simply downloading our podcast. That's at globaljournalist.org. There you can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to the program. This week, we have a timeline of the protests and profiles of Ying Luck and her brother Thaksin. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org, or you can also contact us on our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter, that is at @GlobalJourn. And now we want to kind of take a longer view of the political tumult in Thailand, and I'm joined now by two guests that have decades-long experience working in that country. Steve Herman, he is the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for the Voice of America, and he joins us from Bangkok. Also, Chris Baker, a political observer and co-author of a well-known book, The History of Thailand. And gentlemen, thanks for joining us today on Global Journalist. And perhaps, Steve, we start with you for a little bit of context, if we can. Red shirts, yellow shirts, those are two players, but then we also have the government, we have the military, we have the monarchy. Put it all together for us, if you can, and give us Cliff's notes on this.
Well, it is a bit of a triangle, as you mentioned. And of the three points on that triangle, I would say that the political part of it is by far the weakest and arguably the least influential. Chris can talk about the history of the country going back hundreds of years, where the one stable factor in this current Rama dynasty has been the monarchy. But in recent decades, definitely it has been the military that has played the biggest role as far as the political system goes. And right now we have both the powerful monarchy and the military appearing to sit on the sidelines and letting this political struggle go on in the streets. And as Kuntanyarat pointed out, the red shirts, at least so far, have mainly been sitting on the sidelines. They, of course, back Thaksin and Yingluck Shinawat, but and that seems to be a prudent move by Thaksin, because if there were to be any sort of clashes, it would be a calamitous. I would say that there has been a significant impact so far in terms of tourism in Bangkok. I was at a Japanese restaurant this evening, and the operators of that restaurant were telling me that Japanese businessmen have really been scared away. Their business is way off. Also, we saw that during the Chinese New Year, there was a lack of the Chinese tours coming into the country, not only Bangkok. And that's going to show up in the statistics later on this year. And I think that's also going to lead to more pressure to have some sort of break in this impasse. There are calls for a military coup. So I do think that eventually it's going to be the military, overtly or covertly, that's going to get us through this political impasse here.
And Chris Baker, 18 coups, 23 military governments, 9 military-dominated governments since 1932. That averages basically the military stepping in once every 4 to 5 years. Chris Baker, give us a little bit of context historically about that, and also just a little bit of history about the fact that the red shirts largely come from a northern and very rural area that have given Thaksin Shinawat his support. These yellow shirts tend to be urbanites from Bangkok who traditionally have held sway in the political scene, but seem to be less and less so influential in Thai politics.
The history is a rather unusual history. It wasn't formally colonized. And so the old institutions of Thailand, which particularly meant the monarchy and the military, came up to be its partners in the early 20th century, and the bureaucracy which they created, the modern bureaucracy, remained very, very powerful indeed, and very powerful in running the country. And then when the democratic forces started to emerge, which is really from the 1970s on, these old institutions, particularly the military and the senior bureaucracy, have been very reluctant to release their power to democratic institutions. So we've had a situation in the last few years, particularly, where the last three general elections have basically been overturned in one way or another, one by a coup and the other two, one by judicial action and one by a kind of intrigue. So I think what you're seeing now is still a rather immature political system, because it's been intervened by the military so often in the past, which is now beginning to grow up. There's a lot more popular participation going on. This is something, it's a new thing over the last 15 or 20 years. And the prompting for that came from a couple of things. One thing is the last generation in Thailand was really very successful economically. So everybody today is three times, on average, three times richer than their parents are. So when you get, you know, more money in your pocket, you get better aspirations for your children, you get durables, you want more from the government, you get rising aspirations, and then you start to get interested in politics. And that is really what has happened over the last 15 to 20 years. So a big segment of the population, which really before was kind of out of it, suddenly realized that the vote in particular was a very powerful instrument to get more for themselves. And particularly, it's a very unequal society, so to get more public good.
And Chris, we're gonna try to establish a little bit better audio contact with you, and we'll go back to Steve Herman, and we'll talk a little bit about that equality, because it strikes me, you know, being a distant observer, that the folks in Bangkok who have traditionally held sway are sort of seeking to undo some of this democratic process, and they're asking for various commissions to step in and to operate a caretaker government because they don't like the democratic process, or at least how the votes have turned out, yes?
Well, Well, at least according to the anti-government protest leader, Sutep Toxuban, who has a very interesting history himself, the point that they're making is even if there are elections, there's no way that they can win because Thaksin Shinawat, the former prime minister, has corrupted the system and has essentially been buying the votes of the rural majority in the north, in northeast. And therefore, according to his logic, we need to take a time out from democracy and have this People's Council, an unelected council, run the country for an indefinite period of time, give more power back to the monarchy, and that will sort everything out, according to him. Now, of course, his opponents don't buy that at all. They say basically what he's trying to sell here sounds a heck of a lot like what would be called fascism.
Shinglock's recent political victory was based in, at least in some part, on the strength of this rice buying program. Yet the government has not delivered to the rice farmers in the way that they had hoped or expected. Can you kind of put that into context? Because that sort of throws this urban versus rural sort of conflict into a bit of chaos, does it not?
Right. There's a threat by at least one or several groups of these farmers now to pull their support from the government, which, as was pointed out, is a caretaker government, really can't do anything definitive until we sort out whether the elections are going to continue. And they say that the government has failed to make good on their payments for a pledged rice. And they're now going to try to take some action against the government legally and perhaps on the streets. So the support for the caretaker prime minister, Yingluck Shinawat, the sister of the former prime minister, Thaksin Shinawat, who's seen as running the country from his cell phones in Dubai, is now even thinner.
Thaksin being removed from power and sent abroad, as it were. The king could step in. And is quite elderly, could step in and really, with the mention of a word, to some degree, bring some sort of resolution to this, could he not?
He could. Whether he will remains a very big question at this point. He's 86 years old, and his most recent address on his birthday, it was very apparent that he is in very frail health, and whether he would want to do that or can do that is a big question mark right now. So far, the other powerful institution, as we've discussed, the military, has not stepped in to resolve this. And I think what we may be looking at here is that both within the monarchy and within the military, that there are divisions there.
So what would be the tipping point, Steve? What do you think? What do you think would cause the military to go ahead and say, okay, enough of this? Because certainly there's enough history here with the military stepping in and sort of clearing all parties, clearing the decks, and then bringing it back together. What would
a significant, yeah, a significant breakdown of law and order. We have seen some shootings and some killings at some of these demonstrations in past months, but they haven't approached the numbers that we saw during the previous political unrest. So that would be one obvious sign that the military may be poised to intervene. But I think what we're looking at right now is, short of some royal decree, whether it's a military coup or elections or not having elections or setting up a people's council, that none of those options will resolve this deep divide and this impasse that we have. So trying to be objective, I think that most of the correspondents and many of the Thai people are quite pessimistic that there is any clear-cut short-term solution here.
Not to make tourism the center of the discussion, but Bangkok, the most visited city in the year 2013 on the planet, Phuket, Chiang Mai, places that particularly European tourists flock to, so that it does become central to the conversation. Do you get the sense, and you mentioned this off the top of your comments, that tourism is being impacted?
Oh, there is absolutely no doubt that tourism is being impacted. Just how much, I think, is still not definitive, but based on the sort of subjective feedback that I'm getting from talking to people in the industry and walking down the streets, you can see that it's way off, at least in Bangkok. I think Westerners are still coming in and then going out to the other areas, because if you're going out to Phuket or Pattaya, Chiang Mai, Chiang Rai, Krabi, other parts of the country, you realize all you need to do is get to the airport. Maybe you're going to spend a night or two in Bangkok and then head out, where there really is no problems at this point. And a lot of the Western tourists can sort of figure out the nuance of what's going on, where I think for the Japanese and the Chinese and other Asian tourists or business people, they're not getting very accurate information about just how severe or lack of severity of the situation in Bangkok or the rest of the country, and they're just being perhaps overly cautious. But there is definitely an impact, and the longer that this goes on, the worse it's probably going to be for the tourism sector. And that's definitely going to put pressure on these different factions to try to resolve this.
And with about a minute left here, real quickly, you have seen some of what can happen firsthand. You were down on the streets, and you actually were assaulted for all intents and purposes. Is that true?
Well, I would describe it as a fairly minor assault. A woman who was very upset with foreign news coverage of what's been happening here. She was actually holding a sign that said BBC lies. And although I don't work for the BBC, I guess I was close enough. And she whacked me over the head with the sign a couple of times in front of about several dozen riot police who stood by and did absolutely nothing except take photographs. But it was a very minor incident compared to some of the other violence that we've seen occurring. And you can see that emotions are high, and that also there are various other elements, such as the foreign media, who are being blamed for not portraying accurately or as sympathetically as they would like their side of the story in all of this.
All right. Well, that's going to be the final word, and thank you so much. We have come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were AP reporter Tanya Doxone, Voice of America Bureau Chief Steve Herman, and author Chris Baker. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan. Audio is by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungekar is our executive producer. Victoria Mitsukute is this week's lead producer. And please join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flaney.